Good morning to everyone. The first case on today's call is number 012656, David Masters against the Heston Corporation. Mr. Gifford.
Good morning, Judge Ripple. Good morning, other members of the panel. May it please the court. It is one thing, I think, for opposing counsel to mischaracterize the approach of a plaintiff in a lawsuit in the sense that when they establish or attempt to establish that the theory of recovery sought is alternative design, when in fact it's not. It's another thing for the trial court to adopt or to pay additional service to that mischaracterization of a plaintiff's theory of recovery. I think the ultimate concern that I have in this matter, aside from the fact that we did not seek to recover on an alternative design theory, is that the cases cited by the trial court, such as Baltus, Burrell, Anko, and others, are simply cases which do not, in any sense, go to disqualify Professor Walker as being a substantial and qualified expert in giving expert testimony. In those cases, if your honors will recall, in many of those cases, the expert did not even see the product. In many of those cases, the expert was not even given an opportunity to test the product. In some of those cases, in one of those cases in particular, the plaintiff himself was posited to the court as being his own expert because his counsel failed to disclose an expert under Illinois Rule 220. I hardly think that in a situation like that, it would be fair to suggest that Professor Walker, who not only examined this machine on two occasions, but observed it operating on one, has a fine academic appointment. He is a professor of agricultural engineering. He was aware and articulated in both his opinion, his expert opinion, as well as his deposition, the history of this industry. He also was in a position to talk about the fact that other manufacturers were doing what should have been done. Of course, my opponent would suggest to you that citing and referring to the so-called Model 850 New Holland baler is in some fashion dragging ourselves into the alternative design area. Well, it may be in part, but it certainly wasn't the sole reason for Mr. Walker's opinions, and it is in fact an accurate assessment of the industry that the New Holland baler was an alternative at that time, and it was in fact doing things the way Professor Walker suggested they should have been done.
That was a much more expensive device, though, wasn't it?
It may have been more expensive. I think the primary concern, Your Honor, that Judge Evans, that they cited was the fact that it was so-called chains and slats as opposed to belts and other manners. And I think, frankly, the reality of the design, ultimately, if you recall, in the record in 1987, according to the opposing counsel, they abandoned that machine. It was only around for, 17 or 18 years. The reality is, of course, what they did was they converted it by making it into a belt drive or belt machine.
This machine, as I understand it, was 22 years old or something when Mr. Masters bought it as a used machine.
Correct.
And he picked this one out because it was a lot cheaper than even that 850 machine.
That is a correct statement. He did pick it up because, as I think he testified in his deposition, his budget was limited and he was seeking something that he could afford. Of course, the theory that runs through all of these cases, the non-delegable duty of the manufacturer to make a reasonably safe machine, may be viewed in part by what was current or what was feasible at the time. Certainly, there's no one that's going to suggest, well, I guess my opponent did suggest it, more than just suggest it, but to suggest that this design that we have posited was not feasible in 1975 when this machine was made really doesn't bear much weight. The fact of the matter is, this company, the Heston company, was already in a co-production or in a co-development scheme, was already building a machine without these rollers, and was also building a machine that ultimately would remove the need for such a guard, because the rollers, in fact, would be placed in a position where they would not be in opposition to the farmer's or the user's ordinary conduct. So I think that we don't want to be characterized as an alternative design case. If the court feels that for some reason that has to be, there are cases, as you know. We cited the Niemer case in the Sixth Circuit. I think the Smith case would suggest as well. A number of cases that suggest that this Daubert or Daubert standard is not an all-or-nothing proposition. It may be applied selectively. It may be applied partially. It may very well be that the court feels that the references by Professor Walker in some fashion to the alternative design is, in fact, and not just an effort at showing engineering feasibility, which is why we did it.
But did Walker collect any evidence of other injuries with this same machine?
He did. He mentioned in his deposition that he had had two contacts with individuals. One of them was the Model 5600, and he spoke to a farmer and he gave reference to the fact that he had this conversation and was able to determine that it was the same machine, and his son had lost his arm.
Did that also have this twine problem?
I don't think he said that it did, and I don't think that there was any indication in the record that it did.
But that was the problem, wasn't it?
The twine?
The bent twine shaft, or whatever they call it. What do you call it?
The twine tube.
Twine tube, right. Yes. That is bent and displaced, and you thought maybe welded back on by someone along the line. I mean, that seems to be the problem, wasn't it?
Judge Mannion, that is a problem, and one of the reasons that it was a problem, and we talk about it as something that was reasonably foreseeable, is that it is the mechanism by which it was frequent that people would have to go back into this area where these rollers were. There would be other situations where they would have to, but and the failure to guard it, obviously, is something that they must do and they should have done, even if it would not be likely and frequent that a farmer would be back in that area. But the twine tube itself, you're correct about that, the twine tube itself is what definitely, in this case, had something to do with Mr. Masters being back there. And we mentioned, of course, that...
Well, it probably had everything to do with it.
Excuse me?
Didn't it have everything to do with it?
I mean,
that's why he went back there, because this part wasn't working. And it was a part that had been re-welded on or something by somebody during the prior ownership of this.
Well, there were other situations in the manuals and other troubleshooting areas and so forth where farmers would go back to that area. In this particular situation, Mr. Masters did in fact go back there to, if you will, prime the pump or to put the twine into the baler. That's correct. We think, and I shouldn't say we, I think, and I have submitted in our briefs, we believe that to impose on Professor Walker's testimony and his opinion that was presented under the federal rules, to impose the Daubert standard, and I don't like to use the word arbitrarily, but harshly, it was not only unnecessary in this case, because it isn't the case that requires a Daubert analysis. And I believe that even more importantly, there was sufficient testimony under many of the decisions of this court, Smith for one, Anderson versus Heister, which is the Illinois Supreme Court, which talks about the fact that you don't have to prove a product's negligent, defective design just by means of alternative design. You can prove it by violation of industry standards, and you can prove it by violation of knowledge of the industry. And I would say one other thing, and I don't mean to be patronizing to Judge Reinhardt or to his opinion. However, to suggest that Mr. Walker should reinvent the wheel and design a guard in a situation, or to redesign this baler in a situation where at the very time that this baler was manufactured, that was being done by Heston, and within 18 months of the manufacture of this baler, everybody in the industry was moving the rollers to another location, and/or guarding this machine. So I think that while it may be under a Dobear analysis, that may be something that should have been done, it doesn't require it under Anderson versus Heister. I don't think it requires it under Smith versus Ford. And I think that in this situation, again, use the word advisedly and respectfully, I think it was an abuse of discretion for the trial court to take Mr. Masters' opportunity to present his case to a jury away from him when he had a very well-qualified expert witness who did much, much more. We had one case, the Anko case, where an engineer goes out and inspects an operating system, a corrugated cardboard delivery system, some kind of a conveyor system. The court said in that case he wasn't even qualified to do it, and he never attempted to do it. We have another case where the artifact itself was gone. We have Justice Wood's opinion in the Dillon case, which was a unique design, a situation where a forklift with a rear door and so forth. There was no standard in the industry in that case. There couldn't have been. But in this case, there is an ASAE, American Society of Agricultural Engineers standard. There was industry experience. There was contemporaneous events going on in the industry. There was Professor Walker's background, his teaching of engineering design and mechanical design at Penn State University. This is not the kind of expert I respectfully suggest that Dobear or anything else is attempting to exclude. This man is not in any sense some sort of person who has been posturing or is presenting an opinion that doesn't have the kind of underpinnings, the kind of pertinence, the kind of relevance that all the cases say that it must have.
But when you're focused on the original design and the product itself, if this were strict liability, you'd have the statute of repose to deal with.
You know, that argument, I was going to say, makes my head hurt, but the argument that we made in the brief is, in fact, that the statute of repose should not have been imposed on this case. The 10-year statute of repose was told as a result of the 1997 purchase of the manual by Mr. Masters, and that in fact there was an alteration of this product, and the 10-year statute should have applied, and therefore the strict liability theory should come back into play. And we make that argument in our brief, and I respectfully suggest that that is an alternative basis for relief. Any other questions, I'll be happy to answer, and I'll sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Gifford.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Vernon.
May it please the Court. I'd like to begin with the statute of repose argument. The entire statute is at the front of our brief, and the first section, A, is the definition section. And the issue that's been briefed extensively is whether this phrase, including a failure properly to maintain and care for a product, constitutes a modification. That's a mind-bending and hard question, and I'd like to put it aside and move on to easier questions that are dispositive. Let's assume for the case of this argument that the failure to properly maintain a product constitutes a modification. You then look at Section B, which says if the product is sold, if the injury occurs after 12 years of sale, there's no claim, no negligence, no product claim. Section C sets out the exceptions to the rule of subsection B. C1, C2, and C3, you have to satisfy them all. C1 says you get out from under the statute if the action is brought against the seller making the modification or furnishing instructions for the accomplishment of the modification. Now here the claimed modification is the bending of the twine tube, the rewelding of the twine tube. There is no evidence that Heston bent the twine tube, rewelded the twine tube, or provided instructions to anyone for the accomplishment of that. In the absence of such evidence, we have a burden of proof problem. Now, the district court said there's two Illinois cases. They are the Okasak versus City of Chicago, Henderson versus Jones Brothers Constructions. Those are cited in the appellant's opening brief at page 39. Two Illinois cases that say in these circumstances where you're trying to prove an exception to a statute of repose, the burden of proof lies with the plaintiff. And there's a federal court, district court case that reaches the same conclusion. The plaintiff argues that there are policy reasons why that rule should be different. But it's not the province of this court to overturn the policy decisions of the Illinois courts with respect to where the burden of proof lies in this statute of repose issue. Those cases talk of, the Illinois cases talk about the statutory purpose of the statute of repose being to impose finality, to terminate the possibility of liability after a defined period of time, and that's the policy that they're trying to implement by placing the burden of proof where they place it. And this court should respect that. C2, the second provision that plaintiff would need to establish, is to show that the action commenced within 10 years after the date of the modification. Well, again, there's no evidence as to when the twine tube was bent or rewelded. In the absence of evidence, if the burden of proof is allocated to the plaintiff's claim fails. C3 says a third thing that needs to be met is there needs to be proof that the modification had the effect of introducing into the use of the product unit by reason of defective materials or workmanship a hazard that wasn't previously existing. As we pointed out in our brief, Professor Walker, the plaintiff's expert, testified that he didn't identify any problem with the materials, workmanship, the design of the twine tube. So apart from a matter of statutory construction, there's a failure of proof with respect to C3, regardless of where you place the burden of proof. So the statute of repose was properly relied upon by the district court to dispose of the strict liability count. With respect to the negligence count, the plaintiff's theory is that his expert proved a violation of industry standards, and that's all he needed to do, and that we've tried to turn it into an alternative design case. Two problems with that. One is the expert didn't prove a violation of industry standards. In order to prove it, he would have had to present evidence that was got past the Daubert standard, and the district court, in its discretion, properly held that he didn't do that.
Let's talk about Daubert a minute.
Sure.
The purpose of that rule is to get rid of all these flaky experts, junk science, and all that sort of stuff. Now, this Walker fella is a professional engineer at Penn State. This doesn't seem like the type of person that Daubert is aimed at. Apparently you're going to disagree with that.
I think that the matter of his credentials is one phase of Daubert, and it's a phase that we're not really challenging. If you look at the Kumho tire case, the expert in that case had worked for Michelin for 20 years. There was no question that he had the credentials to make an analysis. He inspected the product, and then he came up with his own methodology as to why his inspection proved a defect, and the Supreme Court said, I'm sorry, as qualified as you are, we're focusing at this point on your methodology, and your methodology doesn't pass muster.
What about Walker's testimony or opinion that he wanted to offer regarding the guards? Why is that excludable here?
Well, the short answer is that in the trial court, in the summary judgment briefs, the plaintiff's argument was the John Deere had a guard for its machine. That guard was actually adopted, and therefore we don't need to test it. We don't need to show that it was feasible because John Deere's a big company. They sold a lot of these bales. If they had a guard on it, that's enough. But the problem is that John Deere didn't have a guard on their machine in 1975. The undisputed evidence is that no round baler manufacturer in 1975, at the time this product was sold, had any guarding system that was more extensive than that was on the Heston machine. So if you can't rely on that existing design, which is sort of an alternative methodology, if you will, to building and testing a guard, then I believe it's incumbent upon you to either build and test a guard or to take the John Deere product out and demonstrate that it works and it doesn't unduly impede function, and perhaps most significantly, that it would have prevented Mr. Masters' accident, which is not a situation where a guy sort of inadvertently fell into the machine, but where he's getting down and reaching within 12 inches of the rollers to feed the twine into it. And the undisputed evidence, Walker admitted, that the baler is designed to pick up a windrow of hay that sits, you know, 12 or more inches off the ground. So if you're going to put a guard down 2 inches from the ground, you're going to have serious problems with function. And what the district court found was that to rely on the ASAE standard, which says that functional components like feed rolls must be guarded to the maximum extent consistent with their function, that to rely on that standard really exposed the absence of methodology on the part of Walker, because he made no effort to demonstrate that any guard that he proposed, what its impact on function would have been. And as we say in our brief, he really couldn't even, as experienced as he was, given his great credentials, and his, you know, he could have been making round bales for 20 years, but when you ask him, well, how far down to the ground should this guard extend? Pretty basic question. He couldn't even answer that question. He said, well, maybe 3 inches, maybe as high as 24 inches. I don't know. Nobody ever asked me to design it. Well, Daubert asks him to define it, and he failed to do so. With respect to the question of the elimination of the feed rolls, that's sort of the alternative design theory. Again, you cannot talk about elimination of the feed rolls. There's an engineering protocol, which isn't really a standard, but Heston doesn't contest that this is an industry-accepted protocol, which says that if you have a hazard like the feed rolls, it's incumbent upon the engineer to design that hazard out if it's possible. So to talk about whether that protocol was violated, you have to address the question, was it possible to design out the feed rolls in 1975? Now, I don't know how you can do that without discussing alternative designs. You've got to talk about the alternative of eliminating the feed rolls. And what Walker did was, all he did was mention the New Holland baler, which was of a substantially different design, and said that that product was introduced in August of 1974. The Heston baler was sold in January of 1975. Therefore, that's my proof that it was feasible in 1975 to design out the feed rolls. Now, there were numerous problems with that, and the trial court at, I believe, page 15 of the appendix, he said, it's not enough to just say, here's a New Holland baler, it doesn't have feed rolls, therefore, it's a superior and safer product. You have to look at things like the cost of it, the reliability of it. Was the New Holland design, which eliminated rubber belts, and it basically had chains that moved steel slats around in a circle and formed the bale, was that design compatible with a rubber belt system which Heston used? And that's particularly important here because Mr. Masters testified that when he was shopping for a baler, albeit 20-year-old balers, he was specifically looking for a baler with rubber belts. He was aware that there were these other ones out there that didn't use rubber belts. That's not what he was interested in. And part of the reason for that was that the chain and slat technology of New Holland was a technological dead end. And if Professor Walker is relying on, you know, history and the history of this development as opposed to alternative design or testing another type of design, it's incumbent upon him to consider the history, which shows that the New Holland design was a technological dead end. Did Heston have a duty in 1975, 6 months after the New Holland design was introduced, to abandon rubber belts, which the industry and the farmers ultimately proved were the accepted design, and to go off on to accept uncritically the New Holland design? We're criticized because we accepted the Vermeer design uncritically, didn't test it enough on the one hand, That's the technology that Heston licensed and did incorporate into the incident baler. And yet then, with respect to the New Holland, we're criticized because 6 months after the New Holland design hit the market, we weren't copying it and doing the same thing. And that even doesn't even address the fact that the New Holland design was patented. So how are we supposed to copy it? How are we supposed to incorporate it? With respect to both of those standards violations, if you will, I think the key point is that both of those issues are reviewed in this court on an abuse of discretion standard. And I think that the district court very carefully looked at what Walker had to offer with respect to the guarding issue and with respect to the design issue, elaborately discussed the Daubert factors, and said that it didn't pass muster. And I think that was a very valid exercise of the discretion and one that should not be overturned. Unless you have questions, that's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Perrin.
Thank you.
Mr. Gifford, you have 2 minutes.
Your Honors, thank you. I've said everything I prepared to say, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Gifford. Indeed, our thanks to both Mr. Gifford and Mr. Vernon for their presentations this morning. The case will be taken under advisement.